It is my great pleasure to welcome everyone today. My name is Nima Paidapati, and I'm the LSE Fellow in Inequalities in the Sociology Department. And tonight we have a panel that I could not be more excited that we are doing. Right? So this evening we have a panel of amazing speakers. They include Faiza Shaheen, the Director of Class, Wilf Sullivan, the Equities Officer at the Trade Union Congress, Noni Makuyana, the co-founder of Decolonizing Economics, and Felicia Odampton, the director of the Black Economists Network. This evening, we will be discussing the ways in which racism has been separated out from the economy and economic discourse, and what we can do to challenge those kinds of separations. So the summer's in the wake of the killing of George Floyd and the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement, both in this country and in the US, we have come to see that racial justice is not only about statues and representation and police brutality, though it is certainly about all of those things, but it is also fundamentally about economic justice, and that we cannot have racial justice without having economic justice as well. But nevertheless, our everyday ways that we speak about racism and have come to learn to speak about racism have fundamentally looked at racism as a problem of society and of politics. And so this is a panel that tries to build on the conversations of this summer to ask a really important question: is the economy racist? Does the economy profit off of racism, racial exclusion? Does it need these exclusions? Does it make those exclusions both fundamental and invisible? Do economists and the work of economics, does it make the work of race and racial exclusions harder to see? And ultimately, if race is important to the way our economies work and generate profits and share those profits, what can we, those who are both on the panel and those who have joined us in the audience, what can we do to fix some of the ways in which there has been silence about the centrality of race to the economy? So with that, I'm really excited to get started. Before we do, let me just say a little bit about the evening's event and how it will be conducted. So I will introduce the speakers one at a time and give them a chance to, from their own work vantage point and efforts as activists, scholars, and community leaders, we'll ask them to reflect on and share their answer to the question, is the economy racist? Is economics racist? After everyone has had a chance to speak, we will try and speak to each other, both about the wider issues at stake and what we can do at a practical level to fight racism in the economy. And then we'll leave, hopefully, about half an hour at the end for questions from the audience. Before I get, the event, by the way, will end at 7 p.m. BST, just so you know. Before we get started, I want to announce that we will have an event very soon, on Tuesday, October 20th, which is the next event in the III series entitled Ethnic and Racial Harassment in Britain. And it is part of a seminar series on migration, ethnicity, and race. And the speaker that evening will be Dr. Alida Nandi of the Institute for Social and Economic Research. And the event will be chaired by Professor Lucinda Platt in the Department of Social Policy at the LSC. You can find out more about this event and other upcoming events at the III by clicking on the link that will soon appear in the chat function. You can also find out more about what's going on at the III this entire term by signing up to receive the III's newsletter, and the link for that will also be in the chat. So now, with all of that as introduction, I'm going to hand it over to the first of our speakers for this evening, who is Faiza Shaheen. Faiza is the director of CLASS, a leading left think tank working to ensure that policy is on the side of everyday people. Faiza was also the head of inequality and sustainable development at Save the Children UK. She was a senior researcher on economic inequality at the New Economics Foundation, and she has written on a number of important economic debates, including about inequality, austerity, immigration, youth unemployment, and social mobility. So I'll hand it over to you, Faiza.
Great, thank you so much, and really pleased to be on this incredible panel and talking about this really important issue. And let me just start by saying I actually approached LSE and the II to do this event, in part because I just feel a frustration at the economics discipline and even us within the think tank world and how little we consider racism and economics together. And I just did this little experiment over the summer whilst thinking about Black Lives Matter. I went through a number of different reports across a number of leading think tanks on where they had purposely had a section on racial inequalities, where they'd spoken about, for instance, there was a paper on different employment outcomes for different race groups. And I went in and I just did a simple control F, looking for the word racism. And not one report, apart from my own think tank and Runnymede Trust, in talking about differences in outcomes amongst Black, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, mentioned the word racism. So they spoke about people having different outcomes, but they didn't really get into why. And there does feel, you know, to me, that just kind of confirms something I've observed over a long time, is that we as a discipline are very scared to talk about racism. And it's really not okay. It's one of the reasons we don't have the kind of systemic change that we need to have. And so, yeah, really pleased to be on this panel and really think that this has got to be the start of more work connecting how vertical, what we might call vertical inequalities, inequalities, economic inequalities and income and wealth are not separate to the inequalities we see amongst racialized groups and even gender, etc. And we need to talk much more about how vertical and horizontal inequalities are working together and feeding each other, in fact. So I think the economy is racist. For those of you that know me, that would not come as a surprise. I think racism is baked into the economy in a number of ways. The first of which, and this is the most common one we would think of, is the way in which individual prejudices play out in particular through the labor market. So you would have seen the countless studies that show if you have a more African sounding name or a more Muslim sounding name, you will have to send far more CVs in order to get a job interview. And you know, we see that prejudice confirmed again and again, and it's sort of in economics kind of considered to be a kind of biased preference, and it is certainly there, and it will, you know, through time and through different policies, it has come up through who gets a loan, you know, and who gets a job, and various other parts of the economy. But I think one of the problems is that that's often where our understanding stops. We often think that people's prejudices, if we just deal with people's prejudices, then the economy and the market would work just fine. But you know, the market, of course, is not a natural fact. It's you know, a historical construct, and markets, profits, capitals, all of these are historical constructs that depend on choices. So whilst it does come up through this biased preference system, it's really not the only way. And that's really just the surface level of the way in which racism is working in our economy. Another way, which I think is getting more attention, is really about the historic way in which certain groups have been allowed to accumulate wealth. And of course, that is connected to histories of slavery, of colonialism, of the empire. But, you know, it's really important to note there that that process hasn't stopped. Still today, you know, certain groups, it was harder for them to accumulate wealth 200 years ago, but still today we find statistics that, for instance, the 1 in 17 black workers in the UK, according to, I mean, this is slightly old data now, 2017 data, 1 in 17 black workers in the UK are in insecure work, which is, you know, much, oh no, not 1 in 17, higher than that. Sorry, I should find that stat again. 1 in 17 overall for the average. And then, I've just lost my stat. So, you know, we know that again and again, when you look at 0-hour contracts, for instance, they are going up much faster for black and brown people than they are for white groups. So, you know, inequalities, even new inequalities in the way that they're playing out, are disproportionately affecting the black and brown population. So, you know, so we understand historically that some groups have been held back, but we need to understand that those same groups are still being held back today. And finally, and this is really where I think it gets a lot deeper and where I think we need to think much more, is to think about the ways in which a very hierarchical economy really thrives on and needs hierarchy across groups. And there's a couple of ways in which this has struck me through my career. One of the ways was, years ago, I was doing a piece of research on non-graduates and the type of jobs available for non-graduates. And as I looked across the sectors where most non-graduates work, so typically construction, hospitality, retail, social care, it really struck me that there was a clear gender bias within it. So for more high-paid non-graduate work, they tend to be male dominated, so construction is the obvious one, but where there were like mostly women, it would tend to be low paid. And it really got me thinking about the way in which market values people and values different people's work. And when I also looked deeper into those sectors, lo and behold, the sectors that were lowest paid were also the ones with disproportionately more black and brown people in them. And so, you know, that really struck me there about the value put on certain types of work. And you know, this is a story that goes back kind of quite early on in my career that really brings home this issue of the way in which markets value things often the way humans value other humans. And this is not a nice thing to say, and no one wants to really admit this, but let's face it, there is a hierarchy, there's a racial hierarchy, and who is valued. Some time ago, I was working at a pretty prominent think tank, and we were talking about a report that we had on immigration at the time. And there was, I think people, sometimes this happens to people of color, everyone else in the room was about 6 people, everyone else was white, and I think they'd forgotten for a second that I was there. And the senior economist said, well, what happened to the Eastern Europeans is kind of what could happen to, or what happened to the Caribbeans and Pakistanis is what could happen to the Eastern Europeans. I'm half Pakistani, by the way. And he said, well, you know, because the Caribbeans and the Pakistanis were invited here to work in particular sectors, and those sectors low paid, and they're no longer needed, and those people would become obsolete. And I remember sitting in that room and hearing, you know, my ancestors, my parents being called obsolete. And no one noticed in the room that that had been said. In fact, another person went on to repeat the same comment. And to me, you know, and every time I say that, it kind of like gets in my heart. But really what he was articulating was that sense of who is valued, and the way in which the labor market then reflects that, where people's jobs are reflects how we see them in this hierarchy, and who is a cog in the machine. And the irony was, the person talking who said this was an immigrant. He was an immigrant from Canada. But he was himself an immigrant, but felt fine to call black and brown people, talk about them in those terms as if we are just cogs in the machine of the economy. And these are very senior people who have, I hate to say, have very senior jobs in the UK right now. So, you know, I really do think when we're talking about the ways in which the economy is racist, there's the way in which people's prejudices play out, there's the way in which the history of who gets to have wealth and even how that accumulates now. But finally, is that point about the way in which the hierarchy of the economy and the labor market reflects and draws on this value system about who matters and who doesn't, which is unfortunately based on the darker your skin is. So, you know, just to sum up, you know, I think this is for me, I'm not a kind of race expert in that way, and I really like to look into some of this in more depth. But one of the things that really strikes me, as I said at the beginning, is that we just can't deal with racism in this country if we're not going to talk about it in regards to economics and the economy. So just really welcome this opportunity here today, and looking forward to what everyone else has to say. Thanks.
That was excellent. Thank you, Faiza, for getting us started. And there is a lot that I certainly hope that we get to come back to and explore and think more deeply about. Our next speaker is Wilf Sullivan, who is the Race Equity Officer for TUC. He has worked in local government for a long time with young people in residential care, with the young people involved in the criminal justice system, and has also worked in information technology, recruitment, and equal opportunities monitoring as a principal personnel officer. So Wilf comes to us with a great deal of experience, especially through the trade unions movement. How would you kind of pick up on the conversation and answer the question, is the economy racist?
Okay, thanks for Nima. And like Pfizer, I really welcome this debate, actually. It's been a long time coming, and for me, you can't talk about race without talking about economics and without talking about politics. And I think it's deeply significant originally when people talked about politics, they talked about political economy. They didn't just talk about economics. Because after all economics is about how we work, how we produce things, and what we do with what we produce. The key question is, who makes the decisions about those things? And who makes the decisions about you know, the surplus we produce and how it's distributed? And therefore, you know, history is important in that, because the way the economic system that we live in was set up lives with us today. Before we came on, Pfizer noticed my background and asked what it was about, and I said I'll explain later. So this is my point where explaining later. Behind me is a guinea. Now, for those of you that are a lot younger than I am, a guinea was a coin which was British legal tender, in fact, until 1971. And the history of the guinea is that Guinea came from Guinea land, and Guinea means dark-skinned people from what was the Gold Coast. And in terms of that, the Guinea, not only did it become created in the 1600s, but it was the coin by which the gold standard was created before it was abolished. And the gold standard, of course, was the central standard in terms of capitalist value and exchange for many centuries. And so we see from that right at the very beginning that race is embedded in the underlying structures of capitalism. It's building, you know, and I would say, building on what Pfizer said, you know, we have to talk about capitalism, because for me, it's not just capitalism, it's racial capitalism. There's no such thing as non-racial capitalism. It's building blocks for conquest, colonialism, dispossession and slavery, and environmental destruction. And actually those things, those dynamics in capitalism exists with us today. Why is race central to this? It's because race is, within that, is a structure of power that essentializes human difference. You know, when we talk about stereotyping, we have to understand that, you know, that doesn't come from nowhere. You know, the racial myths of racial superiority, and which were sort of reinforced through nationalism across the centuries, be it Anglo-Saxonism, Arianism, Nordism, or whatever it is, are still prevalent in mainstream political narrative. They might not be expressed through biology, but they're certainly expressed through culture. And so when we hear discussions about debates around migration, it's almost like, well, actually, we can't have all these people coming in because they'll dilute British culture. So they're very much part of the modern political narrative, and they play out through the labour market. A couple of other things before I talk about the labour market, I wanted to say. Race is also fundamental in terms of that exploitation to the production of violence, really. And violence is really important in this, because violence plays a role. And anybody who thinks that the killing of George Floyd was just about, one policeman being inhumane to another, must remember that those acts of violence are repeated and repeated. And they're about oppression, about keeping groups of people in their place so they can be economically exploited. They're part of the system. So we have to understand that, sometimes when we talk about these things, if we talk about these things without talking about economics, without talking about the systems, we're only talking about the symptoms, not the cause. And why is violence necessary? Because it's necessary for maintaining capitalism and making sure that control of resources and cheap labour to produce commodities, to produce profit, stays in place. These things might be obvious, but we often don't talk about them. We don't say them out loud. And it's really important we say them out loud. And the last thing I'd say on this, right, is that really the other function of race, which we often in the black community don't talk about, is it's the way in which the system captures white working class people and ties their identity to those people that are in power. Right, it's that basic mechanism of divide and rule in the way that it functions. And so we can't attempt to address the intent and nature of racism in the workplace and race equality in the labour market if we don't understand what the nature of the game is. Because if we don't attend to the broader politics of racism, including violence of the state, then actually we don't make any progress. And I think that's been a bit the place. Now, in terms of the labour market itself, Pfizer talked about some of the mechanism that takes place. But I always say that we have to remember that the global division of labour, because when we talk about racism in our economy, it's just a reflection of what happens globally, reflects that history. So the lowest paid and the most precarious workers are those descendants of slaves and those people that were colonized and dispossessed. And you see it across the world. And you see it in relation to the global north and the global south. In a way, what goes on in our communities is a microcosm of what just goes on in the world stage. So in the UK, we have a racialized labor market. And often we only talk about it in relation to access to work. But as far as I said, it's also about work segmentation and segregation, with people almost like imprisoned in various sectors. And if those sectors shrink or disappear, then actually, because they're segmented in the labour market, they suddenly face long-term unemployment, and that we have to talk about, not just in terms of settled communities, but in relation to migrant communities as well. Because what we've seen in the political discourse is this separation of issues of migration and race and the economy, as if somehow or other, migrants are something different from the dynamics of what goes on in race overall. Also what we see in there is work insecurity. And what we've seen since 2008 in BME communities is a massive increase in casualisation. And this is no accident. As the economy has changed, as we see the development of services industries and the need for more, from an employer's point of view, more flexible workforce from their point of view, which one that they can hire and fire at will and pay low wages, then that has played out in terms of the way that race is used in the labour male code. But it's not only in terms of those issues, there's in-work issues as well, you know, about that dynamic, about the lack of promotion, lack of access to training, punitive managerial responses, especially when people raise issues of race in terms of legitimacy, and a lack of protection through health and safety. Well, over the years, always, you know, complaints in black communities about doing the jobs that other people don't want and the most dangerous jobs. And nowhere have we seen that played out more vividly during the pandemic, right? Because that is what is exposed. And all the rhetoric about, oh, health and safety, you know, it's PC, it's the nanny state, has come back to haunt everybody, and especially black community. When we see that lack of health and safety measures have led directly to people's deaths. I'm just going to finish up by saying a couple of things about what from my point of view, that we need to be doing. Certainly from a trade unionist point of view, and I'll be clear about this. I think what trade unions are trying to do within this situation is to ameliorate the system, right, on behalf of workers. And that's important to say, because I think much of the dialogue around race equality and how we do, you know, all around diversity, is if somehow or other we're going to, through diversity policies and other campaigns, get rid of racism. Well, you can't get rid of racism from a capitalist economy, as far as I'm concerned. So what we have to do is change the system. But within that, obviously, you know, there's a debate to be had in the trade union movement, because we're not separate from society. And that's one of the reasons why the TUC has recently set up a task group to look at what trade unions are doing, both in terms of, you know, representation within their structures, within their workforces, and what they do in terms of campaigning and collective bargaining. But I think there's two other things I'll very briefly to say. One, and why this session tonight is so important, is the need for education, for political education. Not education about other people's cultures, you know, education about the way the world works. That's important for me from a trade unionist point of view, you know, because we're actually one of the things that trade unions were concerned in the early days was about worker education. And about workers educating themselves, not the state educating them, but them educating themselves so that they could equip themselves to deal with the system. And I think that's really important and something that we need to get back to do. And the other thing, just to say, is that we need to recollectivise the issues of race. So much of the narrative today is about individual opportunity. I hate the term equal opportunities, you know, because actually it doesn't address the systemic exploitation or oppression and disadvantage that black communities have faced for centuries. And so it isn't talking about redressing that. But as long as we fall into this trap of thinking that somehow race is a zero-sum game, that actually you only get disadvantaged when some racist incident happens, and that actually it's not the very system that is constantly disadvantaging not only black communities but everybody else as well, they're just being hoodwinked, right, then we won't be able to make any real fundamental change to where we're going.
So well, thank there. You so much. That was a wealth of really important themes and conversations. It felt like every single one hit the nail on a really underexplored, crucial head. So I hope we come back to much of what you got us started with. I'm going to pick up on your very last point, which is about education, right? Educating workers, educating the public, educating ourselves, and use that to turn to Noni Makuyana, who has been working in this area of trying to decolonize economics, because I think we get a lot of our knowledge of what the economy is where its efficiencies and weaknesses lie through the discipline of economics, which needs fundamental, in some ways, introspection and revision. So Noni is the co-founder of Decolonizing Economics, which is a grassroots collective working to build a new economic movement that is rooted in racial justice and the decolonial struggle. So maybe she can help us to think a little bit about what a new platform for education would look like.
Thank you. I'm going to start by saying, like, this is the best panel I think I've ever been on, and I'm just so thankful and so grateful to just be learning so much from all of you as well. And so one thing that I always start, like, any of the talks that I do or any workshop that I do, is I like to quote the brown hijabi, who says, to decolonize means to contextualize. And a lot of the systems that we have today are just not contextualized, and we therefore don't really understand how it operates, or we're blocked from understanding how it operates, and therefore we can't really see the beast as what it is, and it just seems as like random situations that are happening across the board, but they are in fact systemic. And then also I'd like to quote another, people say anything's like an African proverb, but an African proverb which says, if you know the beginning, the end will not surprise you. And I think it's especially with the story of the economy, as we've just heard from Pfizer and Wilf, about how the story of the economy actually impacts people on the day to day, and what that looks like in terms of how we understand the economy. So a lot of what we do at Decolonizing Economics is to do that, to contextualize. And we always start our story from the idea, like not even the idea, the fact that the economy as we know it today was a result of slavery. So it was a result of colonialism as well. And like when we look at what colonialism means, it's actually conquering a country to exploit its population as labor and its natural resources as raw material for you to get really rich on, right? So, and also what we do have in the UK is that a lot of this stuff was happening outside of the British shores. And that's why, you know, people always say, oh, you know, Britain isn't as bad as like the UK, as like Britain isn't as bad as the US. But the issue is the UK is as bad and as complicit as the US. It's just our history is based off of the invisibilization of the role that colonialism played in the development of like the United Kingdom, right? And so when through slavery and colonialism, that's how we have the Industrial Revolution, right? We see high street banks as Barclays and like NatWest actually beginning to start being banks, because the slave owners had so much money from just exploiting people, they didn't know what to do with it. So that's how we have Barclays. And we also have like the creation of financial institutions. So through our work with organizations such as like Positive Money and the Finance Innovation Lab, we're really starting to kind of do bits of research on understanding the financial instruments and the history behind them. And so an example of this, right, is, you know, the Bank of England. The Bank of England was directly created to hold the wealth and also to manage like the expansion of British colonial expansion, right? And you know, they were responsible for holding like most of the money and for supporting, and I think some of the governors of the Bank of England were actual slave owners. And you know, like one thing that we always really something I'm personally really interested in is how when slavery was abolished, who got compensated? Not the Africans, the slave owners. And it has really great parallels with how when, with the financial crash, who got compensated? The Bank of England actually paid out a lot of like the banks, I forget the word, but like they paid out a lot of the, what's the word? They paid out a lot of like the banks who had been running up like huge debt as a result of like, trading and selling debt to poor like African people who they knew wouldn't be able to pay back. And what we have here, like we have an economy that is built, and I really liked what Wolf said about like really grounding in on the violence that the economy is built on. And I think a lot of the time from my experience of working in new economics, people are so quick to move past the inherent violence that is at the bottom of the economy. And that's how we have ethnocide and we have ecocide. And when people talk about like the environmental crisis, it's directly related to the white supremacist and like capitalist ideal of just extracting at all costs for labor and for profit. And one thing that I'm really interested in at the moment is how, because we've been thinking about prison abolition a lot, you know, how do we go from slavery to indentured labor to the prison industrial complex? And also, how does that relate to casualized labor? And who is at all, who is the common thread through all of that? Black and brown people who are exploited under racial capitalism. And so that's one thing that we run it, like in our workshops, we like to kind of get people to contextualize like the story of the economy. And then what we have here is just like, at the moment, I'm really interested in, you know, as black and brown people, what happens when the economy exploits you, when you can't feed your family, when you can't get like a job that actually allows you to have freedom and safety and liberation, what happens and what do people do? So our work, how we understand it, decolonizing economics, is contextualizing and also supporting the new economics that we see as being inherent in black communities and the innovation and financial innovation that exists in those communities. And one of the things that we've been doing is kind of archiving and looking back at the history of like self-help strategies and like what that looks like in our community. So it all started when we were thinking about like the Black Panther movement and how the Black Panther started the free breakfast program, right? Because what happens when you can't feed the children in your community? You have to find ways of doing it outside of the state and outside of an economy that benefits off of your like hurt and violence. So we started looking at like, you know, things like the free breakfast movement, and how they would pull together collective resources and work together to make sure that children in the community were able to be fed. And then we also started like kind of thinking in terms of like the UK, what is there that exists? And we started having conversations with black and brown people who had different words to name the similar practice of collective ownership and collective community well-being and how we do that as a form of like economic resistance. So we started finding out that people had like different words for like, is it SUSU and partner system? And in Southern Africa, we call it, well, in Zimbabwe, we call it like burial societies, where you, because black people have a really hard time getting loans and have a hard time getting in like investment into the things that benefit their community. So ways in which people were doing that for themselves. And we found that there was a common thread of how these communities were organizing outside of just this awful, awful system, and like based on like values of democracy, equality and equity, accountability, which are things that just don't exist in an economy that is inherently racist. And one thing that really, I get really excited about when I'm talking about this is the idea that POC, like there is financial innovation that exists within POC communities, right? But then under like this whole new economics thing, people tend to just forget like the idea, like I've been in so many spaces where like in white spaces where they're just like, why aren't people of color interested in economics? But the issue isn't that POC aren't interested in economics, it's the language and the parameters with which we draw what is economics and what isn't. So, you know, why isn't like my grandma's burial society understood as a form of financial innovation, you know? Why is it that, you know, this land justice movement or like people putting money together to buy food is not understood as a form of economics? And one thing that we've been really finding out, like me and Guppy, is that, who's my co-founder at Decolonizing Economics, is that this history is like intentionally silenced. There is an intention behind silencing these amazing stories of economic resistance. And for example, with the Black Panthers, they actually got shut down by the police. And they were under like threat, they were understood as terrorists. Are you being a terrorist and trying to feed children? That's something that we should think about. And also, you know, and seeing like some of the work that we've seen coming out during the quarantine is, you know, I've seen so many great POC organizations fundraising and like building enough resources to do the stuff that is inherently important to the people that the economy should serve. And also, I forgot to say, like, another part of like what we teach the economy is at Decolonizing Economics is managing the home, because if we manage the home to feed ourselves, to clothe ourselves, to have safety, that's how it should be, as opposed to just getting like, I don't know, 2% of the population really rich. That's just not what the economy should be. And I think one thing that I would really like to land on and just to end on is just, I'm really interested in how, like, as also Faiza touched on, like the idea of what is economics, right? And under white supremacy, the word, like the way that we understand economics, does not liberate us all collectively, it liberates a few. And I'm so interested to hear the stuff from the Black Economics Network to, because, you know, how are we opening up like the creative capacity of what we can do with economics? And something else that I always think about is how economics is sometimes removed from society, right? So it's removed from other disciplines like art, like, I don't know, health, like care. It's seen as something that is just different and on its own and just operates on this weird cloud in the air somewhere that people don't have access to. And I'm just really interested in these conversations of how we can ground economics to be something of more about collective knowledge and collective power and collective liberation. And yeah, that's, and also to stop new economists, people appropriating the resistance and like the language of resistance that Black and brown people have been doing for years and like parading it as new. It makes me very mad as well. So I'm just gonna hand over. Thank you.
Excellent. Okay, so with all of that, as more food for thought in this conversation that I think is really building up in interesting ways, it reminds us that in order to decolonize the economy, we have to change the way we think about it. And so we have to change the way we think about and do economics. And that is a really nice segue into introducing our next and final speaker, who is Felicia Odampton, who is the founder and director of the Black Economists Network, or TBEN for short. Felicia is a UK-based economist. She's a fast stream economist in the UK civil service, and she's currently working in the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government to provide economic advice on the current state of the housing market. And her organization, it tries to support and inspire Black economists while challenging the lack of diversity in the field of economics. So Felicia, I'll hand it over to you.
Hi, I just want to check, can you hear me? Okay, that's great. Yeah, thank you for that introduction. And I wanna say thank you to Noni, to Wilf and Faiza for like just laying out the foundation. I don't think that I can add anything more because everything that you said, I completely agree with, like, yeah. So my answer is basically yes, but I'll dig into that from a little bit of a different perspective as well. So I just really wanna run through about like what economic theory and economics kind of promises, but then also how that interacts with race, or if it does at all, you know, debunk some of these myths and talk about what we could try to do, well, as economists to solve that. So yeah, so put very simply, of what we understand of the economy and how it operates is that it focuses on, is based on mainstream economic principles. It focuses on the rational, self-interested agents whose behavior is defined as maximizing some kind of utility subject to some kind of a constraint. The framework in which it does so is putting emphasis on supply and demand, utility maximization, rational choice, and it assumes perfect knowledge, such that whatever the outcome is, no matter what it looks like, markets always clear and reach some kind of equilibrium. Equilibrium here can be understood as some sort of balance. This framework and how the economy operates underneath it is presented as if it's objective, unbiased, and non-ideological. But it's important to note that with like any subject in the social sciences or the social sciencey domain, it's a social construct and it's underpinned by ideologies. The economy, the system through which it operates, is guided by political incentives, beliefs, which when actualized and realized have negative implications for various minority groups, ethnic minorities in this case. And to quote economist Joel Gamble, racism is a system that manifests in norms, institutions, and policies. When economic analyses fail to account for these institutions, they perpetuate racist outcomes. So how does the mainstream understanding of the economy and economics interact with race? Well, it doesn't really. much like our general understanding of the economy, race and economics is treated as an exogenous variable, like an ad hoc part of analysis. I don't know if any of you had gone through economics class and you're doing econometrics and, you know, you add race as a variable as if it's like just an extra thing, as if it's not integral. Yeah, that's how most of how we treat race and economics. It's a bit of like ad hoc, kind of similar to how they treat gender or class. And it's not explicitly incorporated into our main frameworks of understanding, which is interesting because, like Wilf expanded on, our understanding of mainstream economics comes from European transformation. And race was actually quite a significant factor in determining the distribution of resources on the global scale. So it's quite interesting how it's treated as separate, even though that was the foundation in which the economy was built on and capitalism works. But yeah, and Wilf put that perfectly, I think. He really explained that. So yeah, so by treating race or ethnicity as an exogenous variable from our understandings of the economy, any discrimination is therefore justified. This is because, according to this mainstream framework, whatever the outcome is, market's always clear and this is a balance. Therefore, discrimination is actually just a revealed set of preferences by the agents who are working to maximize their utility. So it's basically saying that racism is integral to the way the economy works, which is basically what everyone here has said. But of course, that's really harmful. And as we see that play out, interestingly, economists have done a really rubbish job at actually revealing this. The IMF has found that despite, you know, some progress, economists still pay little attention to race relative to other topics. They found that for every article in the top 10 economics journal over the past 10 years, only 0.2% of those, which was 7,920 articles, cover issues of race, racial inequality and racism, compared to gender, which is 0.8%, poverty, which is 1.4%, and income distribution, which was 2%, which are really some of the big topics going on in the world right now. So really, I don't know what's going on in the field, but we need to fix it ASAP. So what are the consequences of this? As a result, this systematic racism results in widespread economic costs. It costs the individuals and particular community groups, as well as the economy. For the individual, it prevents them from making the most of their economic potential. Racism has restrained Black and Brown communities' progress for decades. And we see that in play out in various stats. If we're looking at wealth, we see that for every £1 that white households have, Black African households have just 10p. When we're looking at the medium household worth, we see that Black Caribbean households were worth about £89,000 compared to white British households, which were worth £282,000. Then we go into income, because if you don't really have an income, how can you build wealth? Well, then we see that the average hourly pay for Black people has hovered between £9.91 and £10.80 between 2013 and 2018, whilst white people saw wages consistently rise from £10.58 to £11.87. And some could say, okay, well, don't get employed, maybe you should just go and work for yourself. But studies have found Black entrepreneurs find it harder to raise funds. A study by Warwick has found that Black entrepreneurs are actually charged higher interest rates. And this is actually due to the fact that they have lower savings, and it all comes down to neutral credit decisions made by algorithms, which just reinforce the bias. But how can you have all these savings if you're not even getting employed? So what we find is that Black people are seeing at least double the rate of unemployment as white people, and that was between 2004 to 2018. And like Faisal mentioned earlier, research has shown that job applications from people with white sounding names were 74% more likely to receive a positive response than people with ethnic minority sounding names, despite having the same qualifications. And then this plays into things like home ownership, where we see that people of Arab, Black households are not owning their homes and have a high percentage represented in social housing. And it is important to note that a lot of these gaps reflect the historical discrimination that Wilf had touched upon, inequalities in wealth compounded over time. And as we know, racism has made it harder for Black and other ethnic groups to even qualify for housing in the 1970s, and then we're seeing that play out over time. So that's all to say, the way in which the economy functions, it deprives the individual from reaching their full economic potential. It also can deprive the economy of actually reaching its own full potential. Evidence has found that using examples from the US and France's case studies, that reducing racial gaps in access to employment, working hours, education, and recovering investments and consumptions loss can cause significant boosts in GDP, in some cases up to 6%. So is the economy racist? Well, yeah, because it operates in a way which is not favorable and does not work in the best interest of those who are discriminated against. If the system and everything that feeds into it isn't racist, why do we observe the outcomes that we do? And clearly it's not down to individual behavior alone. So that argument cannot fly. And I think the other panelists have definitely demonstrated that today. But I also want to add that the economy is as racist as it is misogynistic and as it is classist as well. And when you intersect all three of these, you just have a recipe for disaster. This is not to say though that ethnic minorities cannot thrive. I think a lot of the pushback recently with Black Lives Matter, some people try to separate themselves, like, oh, but you know, we have Black millionaires, you know, we can do good. It's actually just trying to say that the odds are that if you are from those marginalized groups, you'll face significant barriers due to systematic racism, which will hold back your potential. But it doesn't mean that you cannot thrive, but there are barriers there and they are systematic. And finally, I just want to go into what can we do about this? What can be done? Well, from a general perspective, as individuals, there's only so much we can do to try and force systematic change. The bulk of the work lies in the hands of those who make and create policies. And that requires a lot of political incentive, which I'm not really sure we have right now in the UK. Many people aren't really too invested in racial equality. And I think people don't really understand what's going on. That's why I think initiatives like decolonizing economics are so important. Hopefully people will be open to learning from these things. From an economist perspective, I think that we have a lot of work to do if we genuinely care about race. We hold some of the most powerful positions in society. We're able to form policies that change lives. But these recommendations for policy are dependent on theory and analysis underpinning them, and whose perspectives are being included. Therefore, we have a role to play in the action for change to help build inclusive systems for the benefit of all. And that includes increasing diversity of the profession. This is because, like I said, it all depends on whose perspectives are being included. So lack of attention to issues justified by certain assumptions can ultimately lead to poor decision making and policy, negative outcomes for groups, especially Black and brown communities, which we have already witnessed. And I'll just give you an example. When I first started working in as an economist, you know, I think that was like 2 years ago or 3 years ago now, I can't remember, but it wasn't that long ago because I'm still quite early on in my career. I remember we was doing some analysis and we needed to break it down to see the impact of analysis on different protected characteristics. So that's gender, race, different classes and all of that. And I wanted to break it down by race, but go into like more granular. And then a colleague, policy colleague, was like, oh, let's just do the analysis on white and non-white. So if there wasn't any pushback on that, that's how policies would have been advised based on analysis that was literally white, non-white. And we wouldn't even understand the impacts of what this policy would be having on different community groups. And this is why it's important that more of us take an interest in that and also challenge the system, challenge how policies are being created and the processes behind them. But yeah, this is all to say that the economy is quite racist, so we should try and do what we can to stop that from happening. But that does require a massive shift and a complete revolution of the system. That's all from me.
Well, that was both sobering and a call to arms. And so I hope we get a chance to pick up more on those final points about thinking, well, this is going to require hard work, right? And so how do we do that work? How do we sustain people who are doing that work? And all of you who are building networks and supporting other people, how can we support those networks? So I hope we come back to that towards the end. I just wanted to say for those in the audience, if you would like to ask our participants questions, you can put them into the Q&A, which we will start in about 10 minutes or so. I just wanted to take this opportunity to draw out some of the really important ideas and thoughts that have come out of this conversation already. So we know, you know, just from listening to the press, the way in which the economy is racist in the sense that it unequally distributes the rewards of profits and growth, right? So we know that there is a massive wealth gap when we look at the amount of wealth that Black and Brown people have in this country, in many other countries. We know the discrimination in terms of employment, in housing, in all of these different domains, right? So we know that the economy treats Black and Brown people differently. However, sometimes we don't necessarily think about, and I think this is the really important thing that the conversation has also helped to bring together and crystallize, which is the idea that the economy, especially the capitalist economy, our contemporary global capitalist economy, uses and requires race. So I come from a background where once upon a time I was trained as a development economist and then became a historian and an anthropologist. Very recently, I have been thinking about the extent to which race itself as a historical category in different parts of the world at different times is made fundamentally through the economy, is made through the creation of categories of property, of the division of labor. That is how race is made, and it is how it continues to be made. And so this is speaking a little bit to where Faiza started us with, thinking about how is it that certain kinds of labor, which is deemed unskilled, is largely done by people of color, by migrants, by women, by people in incredibly marginalized and precarious situations. Economics treats this reality, as Felicia has told us, as though it's an externality, right? That what we are interested in is the skills and not the people doing those particular jobs. And yet, this conversation reminds us that we cannot and do not value people's labor separately from how we value their humanity. And so if certain forms of labor are undervalued, it is fundamentally tied up in how we value them as people. And that is something that has been really starkly brought out in this current COVID crisis, where we now see that the workers that are essential for keeping us alive and keeping us around and keeping us fed and keeping us safe are some of the most low-paid workers in our communities, right? So whether those are the workers restocking shelves in supermarkets or doing care work or working in hospitals or working as cleaning staff, but this is essential work and we don't pay it very much. And that is, you know, how does economics as a discipline explain that? Because economics tells us that people are valued according to the value that they bring to the economy. And yet all of this labor that is fundamentally valuable to us is something that we underpay, right? And so how does that come about? And I think unless you put race into that mixture along with and inseparable from class and gender, you won't get an answer to how we ended up in that particular situation. So for instance, I was talking to Faiza earlier about how the one job I have ever asked anyone to do for me that is the most, is the job that I valued the most, is the childminder who looked after my child when I went back to work, right? There is not one job that I could ask somebody to do that is more valuable to me, right? It is like putting my life in their hands. And yet we pay childminders nothing compared to that real value, right? And we know that. So how did we come to be in that situation? I think that unless we can come to grips with how race operates as fundamental to the economy, we won't really get to those kinds of answers. And so what I want to say, kind of as a historian, is that race has been made historically through these categories of value that tie human value to financial value. And until we kind of get to that and get to know how to analyze that, it is really hard to kind of provide the real solutions for this. But social movements and political movements have been showing us this all along. So my final comment as a historian is to remind us that, you know, anti-colonial struggles, anti-racist struggles have fundamentally been struggles against the economy, right? So whether those are rent boycotts in South Africa, whether those are, you know, anti-colonial boycotts like salt marches in India, whether those are about who gets to sit at the front of the bus or who gets to sit at the lunch counter in the US, that struggles for racial equity and recognition have always been struggles about and over the economy. And so I think that the work of this panel is really crucial, and it has been a real joy to be here and to listen to all of you. I'm going to ask one kind of final question, which many of you have actually already begun to answer, right? But I wanted to give everybody one last opportunity to kind of think about it collectively, and then I will open up the floor to questions. And so my final question is to think about the practicalities. What can we do to make the intersections of race and the economy visible when often they are invisible in the field of economics and invisible in our public discourse? How do we combat racism, both in the economy and in economics? People have already said wonderful things, but I want to kind of pull that thread out of the discussion out just a little bit further.
Shall I start?
We could go in any order, but why don't we go in the order we started, just so that everyone gets a chance to speak. Is that all right? So we'll start with Faiza again.
Great. Yeah, thank you. It's been great to listen to everyone. And I guess just picking up on your point about, we've been looking at this quite a lot at the Center for Labor and Social Studies at CLASS, is this way in which we term certain workers low skilled. And, you know, it's a status used in the Home Office to say which people can and can't come to this country as well. But a lot of those so-called low skilled jobs are exactly the jobs that got us through the pandemic, in particular around care. And I really do think, you know, this is partly about language and the need to stereotype certain people, because how do you justify the types of inequalities that we see in society today unless you can find ways to denigrate some people that are the losers in that system? So that can look like calling people skivers, which was a very dominant political narrative that we saw come out between 2010 and 2015 in this country. It can look like racial stereotypes that are, you know, might not be explicitly said in the same way anymore, but are there within our media, in the way in which certain groups are presented. I always talk about this. My husband has worked as an actor for the last 15 years or so, and he's of Turkish origin. And the amount of times he gets scripts and the character breakdown is Middle Eastern looking, mean, and that's it. Like some type of way of saying that. So, you know, the way in which we, these messages of different black and brown people as not being, not being the same. And then when you feed that back into the economic system, then of course, then people don't ask the questions about why are they termed low skilled? And if we called them low paid instead, what kinds of questions would that bring up with the public? And so when we're talking about what to do, the very first thing we have to do is to call it out. Is every time you hear someone talk about someone as low skilled, which is dehumanizing that person, is to say we shouldn't call anyone low skilled. They're low paid. Those skills have been fundamental to this economy. If we've just learned anything, I mean, Priti Patel is still talking about low skilled, even though we've just been through the pandemic, or we're still going through it, and people are still out there working, delivering our post in our supermarkets, looking after our parents and grandparents. And so we cannot have that kind of language anymore. Language is really important to the way in which certain groups are dehumanized, and low pay is justified. But I also think as anti-racists, we have to fight much more for higher wages, higher minimum wages. We need to also promote trade unions. Trade unions are certainly not perfect, and themselves have issues with racism within them, of course. But we have to make sure that people stand together and find ways to build collective power. We have to make sure that we fight for decent housing for people, for all people, and that will disproportionately affect people of colour. And we will find also if we do things like banning 0-hour contracts, and the statistic I forgot earlier, so 1 in 8 black workers are in insecure employment, whereas it's 1 in 17 on average. Now 1 in 17 is already bad, but 1 in 8 black workers in insecure, you can imagine then the repercussions for their life. So if you start saying we're not going to have these 0-hour contracts anymore, we're not going to have these insecure employment contracts, then of course, which is the group that benefits the most, it's ethnic minority groups. And I would say this, you know, I one of the reasons I was so excited about the way in which we are talking about race post the horrific murder of George Floyd is that, especially amongst young people, the discussion about systemic change, because it felt like for a long time in my 20s that we, as well as corporate feminism, we also had kind of a anti-racism that was simply about, as long as we have as many black, you know, more black millionaires and more brown millionaires, then the system's sorted, the system's working. But, you know, I always used to say that that kind of system still means, you know, still means that there are a lot of people in misery, that is keeping everything in its place and just saying we'll put a few more black faces at the top. But I've also come to realize that you actually cannot address the economic system without addressing racism and vice versa. And I do really think that we have to keep with this kind of radical line of thinking, and we can't go back to saying, well, as long as we have more black, rich black people, then it doesn't really matter if there's poor black people too. That we cannot accept that. That's not what we're fighting for.
Wolf, do you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, I just wanted to do a couple of things. One was to pick up this on this question of low-paid workers, I mean, and low-skilled workers. Firstly, by saying, of course, Felicia was quite right in pointing out these are all just human constructions within an economic ideological framework, which has got nothing to do with the real world. And the interesting thing for me about how work is valued is that, and I referred to it, I was talking about before, that actually cheap labour is created, right? And what's quite, you know, what's quite interesting, I've negotiated with everybody from Serco to local authorities to your local, you know, your local parking company. But of course, those people, oops, sorry. I need to find the bloody phone to turn it off. That's my daughter. But those people that are paid the least, those areas where people are paid the least, is the area of biggest profit. And we must remember that. It's about exploitation. It's about why in the Congo people are digging coltan out of the ground with picks and shovels when it could be mechanized. Because it's cheaper and it's more profitable, you know, and that's an essential mechanism of the way that capitalism works. So it's not about, when people talk about skill and value, it's not that those things are real, it's that somebody's made the decision that that's the way they will be treated. right? And they've made that decision on the basis that it's profitable. So when I used to deal with companies like Mediclean, and they'd say, oh, well, you know, it's very labour intensive, we haven't got any money on the contract, I wouldn't look at the contract books, I'd look at the company books. And when you looked at the company books, right, which did you see the biggest area of profit? It was cleaning, right, over anything else. Why was that their biggest area of profit? Because they could pay people, mainly women and black workers, poverty wages and give them insecure terms and conditions. So it's, you know, in terms of the way that those kinds of sort of economic theories and the way they rationalize actually play out, we have to always remember that actually exploitation is at the center of it. I mean, I think for me, one of the things that I think is really important is what Nola was saying about alternative economic models and the fact that, you know, actually we have a history of those kinds of things in the black community. And we have a history of those kinds of things in terms of black politics across the world and here, and that they're still going on. And that actually, one of the things that we have to do when thinking about sort of new economics, and I hate that term, but alternative economics, is not just about coming up with the theories, but how we can actualize that in our communities so that we can support ourselves and keep money in our communities. So, for example, I'm involved with trying to promote the work of the African Credit Union, who are trying to set up a national credit union, which is based on the idea of using money from the credit union to promote cooperatives in our communities. Because quite rightly, they see cooperatives in our communities as a way of providing employment and providing a sustained economic model for the community where money stays in the community and people can actually benefit from that. Because we've got to get away from this idea in terms of business, that business is about creating millionaires, which is one of the things that's pushed at us all the time. Entrepreneurship. You know, entrepreneurship is like, this is the way to, you know, own your own Caribbean island and have a £1 trillion in offshore bank accounts. You know, the purpose of our economy is to, you know, is to sustain us, right? So that we could all have a reasonable life and that we can actually live to our potential. And so I think, you know, developing things which are aside from and outside of the system is really important in the process of what actually we need to do in the future.
Excellent. Noni?
So thank you to Faisal and Murph. Each time like I come on, I'm just like, everyone said everything that was great, you know, what more to add? But I think for me, one thing that I think is really important in terms of like shifting the economy as it is, it's just, I think a lot of white people in the space just take up a lot of space and they don't actually have that, like, I don't know, there's not a lot of the innovative ideas, or like, it's not even a lot of, there's no recognition of the people that have come there before and have done the work. And I'm off all the strategy of just getting out the way and letting the people who have the ideas, who need, and I think the biggest issue is that lots of like black people and brown people are just under-resourced. There's a real issue of just like, there's a lack of resourcing those innovative ideas that will make the economy what it is. And I think one of the things that we do at Decolonizing Economics is helping to create infrastructure to redistribute to a lot of the grassroots initiatives that we see. For example, I'm not sure if people have seen like Kwanda, which is like an online black cooperative, really. And they basically fundraise to redistribute to specific causes across like the black community. And that is in itself just so innovative. But I think for them to even do that work probably comes with a lot of challenges and a lot of barriers to just do something which is so abundant in how much it can like liberate and change a lot of like what people are going through and stuff. And I think something that people should, a lot when I think of like new economic spaces, there's a real like hoarding of funding. There's a real hoarding of resources. There's a real hoarding of relationships as well, that I just think there needs to be. I think also we need to move from the fact of, like, I think white people should move from the idea that, you know, privilege exists, but what are you going to do with it, right? How can we move past the conversation on, like, our own personal failings, as opposed to how can I use my privilege or the things that I have access to actually elevate and platform people who are, like, under-resourced as well? And I really like the point that Wilf has mentioned as well, cooperatives. I just think cooperatives are such a great model in actually, they have so much political power and they have so much, like, actual, they support and, like, raise the well-being and just life of everyone in abundance. And it's like, how can we mainstream, or not even mainstream, like, reclaim cooperatives as a POC and, like, a Black-led thing? Because at the moment, we just see cooperatives being platformed by people who are middle class and white, who have money to just invest in things because they've inherited it. But, like, how can we, because I feel like Black people and brown people are already doing a lot, and I actually think it's more about white people just stepping up and actually maybe just moving out the way and redistributing their resources so that things that are, like, pointing the future forward can, yeah, go through. And that's all I had to say, actually. Cooperatives are great, and I'm just really excited about, like, the reclamation of, like, cooperative models that has been happening a lot during the pandemic. And also, no more Black millionaires. No. That's me.
Felicia?
Yeah, so I just wanted to reiterate what everyone has basically said, and I guess more of what I'm going to say relates to what Noni has just said, basically, and points that I touched upon earlier. I don't know about you guys, but when I was studying economics, I was like, yeah, this subject is interesting, you know, yeah, like, we're looking at how we can get the economy. And then I saw the reading list and I said, wait a minute, what's going on here? And then I looked at, oh, who's winning the prizes in economics? And I was like, hang on a minute, all these main, these big economic ideas on how we're going to get the economy, we're going to work for people, they're all centered around whiteness. And that's why the economy is working for white people, but it's not really working for people who are not white. On a global scale, it's not just in the West, but it's a global thing. And then you read other books and you read other articles written by people on the ground, people on the continent of Africa or from the Caribbean or in Asia, anywhere that's not considered, you know, the West. And you're like, hang on a second, they have new, fresh, innovative ideas on how we can do things. But this is not taught in the mainstream economics, which is the Western economics, which is the dominant form of economics, which basically runs the whole world. And I think in order to make an economy that works for everyone is to incorporate these ideas. So I really like what Noni was talking about when she was speaking earlier about why are systems of, like, SUSU or PADNA or cooperatives not considered a form of economics that we can even teach people and is actually something that can help people. And that's part of the reason why I started the Black Economist Network, because I was reading economics and I'm looking at who's getting the accolades for it, I'm looking at the people of my community are still at the bottom, and I'm like, these people haven't done anything for me in my community, so I don't know why they're getting all these rewards, because we're still in the same position. Yeah, things, okay, first there's been some progress, yeah, but there's not been that much progress, like, nothing has leveled out. And I want to actually hear the perspectives and learn from people in my community who might have new ideas. It's quite lonely as well when you're in a space of, like, it's very white dominated and people having these ideas, and you kind of feel like, oh, I have an idea, but I don't want to share it. So I created the space for the Black Economist Network for Black economists. It's not just Black economists, but anyone who's in economics or related fields. So we can actually have a safe space to talk about our ideas. We can debate them and stuff like that, and also try and inspire people from the younger generation who might want to come up and be economists or have alternative ideas, but also people who may not be economists but come from other fields as well, because economics does a really bad job in demonizing any other field that is not, you know, it's markets, stocks, prices, all of this. No. We need to stop that, because how are we going to make the world a better place for everyone, especially people from marginalized communities, if we're demonizing other fields of study? We need to actually bring all of it together and create an inclusive economy. So essentially, my argument is to diversify economics, but it's not about, you know, like Faiza was saying, putting more black faces and say, yeah, because some people are still agents of white supremacy, regardless of skin color. They're still going to create the same systems that perpetuate inequality. And that's because they've been taught the way that the institutions teach us white Western economics, mainstream economics, and may not have a different perspective, which is fine. That's life. But then we also want to diversify perspectives and include perspectives that are underrepresented and are quite innovative and will actually make some real change. So that's all I have to say.
Okay, so I'm mindful of the time, but I have really appreciated everyone's contributions and questions, including the questions from the audience. So my apologies in advance if I'm unable to get to your question. Given the time, it's likely that I might not be able to, but nevertheless, your community presence and questions are very valuable, and we get to see them and get to engage with them. And I think that some of the questions which I see pop up in my screen are about what are the things we can do? What is the single most important thing we can do? And I think from our panelists, we have a set of some really concrete, important things, starting with things we can do ourselves by changing our own language, whether or not we are, you know, economists or in this particular field of activity at all, right? That all of us can be mindful of the kind of language we can use. So we have some practical suggestions on the table that are really important. Here are two questions. I've kind of combined a couple of questions that have been asked, but one of our audience members is asking, are we saying the economy is racist, or is it capitalism that's racist? And does the difference matter? Another member of our audience wants to know more about mutual aid societies. Is the kind of path forward something that looks like the decommodification of labor? Will that help bring racial justice to the economy, right? Because are we really diagnosing something that is about capitalism? And finally, as part of that single conversation, one of our audience members, Rosa Vaughn, is from Cuba, where she points out that there the economy is not a capitalist economy, and yet the hierarchies of race, of discrimination in terms of gender, in terms of sexuality, all of these things still occur. And so how do we root out such hierarchies, even in non-capitalist societies? Because even non-capitalist societies are formed by the long histories of racism, slavery, colonialism, and exclusion. So that's a lot of questions, but they're really fundamentally about, is this only about capitalism? If so, what do we do? If not, what do we do? Anyone can jump in.
Shall I go? I'm just wary of time. There's just a couple of things I was thinking about in terms of ideas that we can take forward after this panel with LSC. Is one, we really should have an essay series from just black and brown people on what should be done in the economy, on ideas, on pushing the boundaries. I'd love to see Nonna and Felicia to write a chapter, calling out to LSC and people that have money for funding. These two young women should be doing PhDs in economics. We don't have enough black people in economics, absolutely, and we need to come forward and fund the incredible talent that we have and really push that forward. On the questions, and there's like a great set of questions, I know people are asking also about the difference that coronavirus will make. Firstly on capitalism, is this the economy or capitalism? You know, this title comes from something I was asking the BBC to, I asked the BBC to do a documentary or three documentaries on, is the economy sexist, is the economy classist, and is the economy racist? They refused, maybe too radical for them, but there are documentaries that I have done with BBC in the past. Maybe I should go back to them again now, but it really, for me, you know, it was really just an observation of the economy that we live in. But I think, you know, in a way that's answered by the person that's from Cuba, that we see it within our systems here, and I've thought about it much more from a kind of perspective of the way capitalism works, because, you know, I and most of the people I love live in a capitalist economy, so I can see the way it plays out. But certainly racism, you know, is there in socialist societies, is there in communist societies. You know, you have to deal with also the issue of prejudice. And I always say this to sometimes people on the left will say, as long as you deal with class, then, you know, those racist, that kind of racist hierarchy will go away. And it's just absolutely not, you know, you have to do both things. I think Cuba is a good example of where the economic system, it might be flatter in terms of those vertical structures, but those, unless you deal with also the prejudice that sits within the systems and the history, you know, try and undo that history in whatever that way that might look like, reparations, for instance, you can't, you know, you'll still again see that racial hierarchy come through.
I just want to say, you know, and I suppose I started off by saying that for me, economics was different from capitalism. You know, the economy is a basic part of what we do to survive. It's a system that we've constructed around it which race and class are a crucial part of. And I suppose I also think, for me, also from my political perspective, it's also about democracy. And I think, you know, and about who has power in a society and how that's distributed and how that's used. Which is why it isn't just about capitalism, you know. For me, you know, I'm a socialist, and a democratic socialist, so democracy is central to the question about, you know, how our societies run and how everybody's needs are taken into account. And so, you know, it's not just a matter of saying, oh, well, if we get rid of capitalism, racism will go, because that's not the case. You know, it's how democratic and how do we organise the societies, you know, after that. Just wanted to make the point, because it's a sort of another a point about cults, really, and the history of them, because there is a history. And co-ops in this country are one of the most regulated forms of business that you can set up, right? Why is that? Because actually in the 1930s, when people started to doing it, it was seen as a real threat to the established system. So what the system did was regulate it and make it as very difficult as possible to create co-ops. And so we have to understand that in terms of and I often think this is a lacking in terms of our discussions about alternative economics. You know, questions of power, right, and whose interests to serve also have to be taken into account there. Because actually, if you don't, then what you will find is that in anything that you do to challenge the system, there is always going to be a reaction. And you have to take account of that reaction if you're actually going to build something sustainable.
If the other panelists don't mind, I'm going to bundle together a few more questions and have that be the kind of last round of the conversation for this evening. So there are a series of questions that have come in asking us to think about the institutional frameworks of the economy and what we can do to change them. A lot of our conversations, understandably and importantly, have been about recognizing the work that race does in the economy, making that work visible, giving platforms and voices to people who make that work visible. But one of our final questions, which comes from S.E. Clark, asks about the COVID crisis and whether the COVID crisis will entrench economic inequalities. Because a lot of platitudes have been expressed about the value of low-paid key workers during the first wave of the crisis, and yet the government has shown no real attempt to reflect this with financial reward. So even when we recognize and say and clap for the value that key workers give us, and that we depend on, that our very survival depends on, we are not actually changing the way we reward people in terms of security, in terms of money, in terms of seniority, in terms of other things, in terms of other ways of shattering hierarchies, right? And so similarly, you know, recognition is the beginning, but how do we begin to change the institutional frameworks that create certain and reproduce dominance? So another question that has come in is about how do we close global tax havens? There's an article recently, I will put it in the chat while everyone speaks, by a really amazing historian, Vanessa Ogle, who shows that the creation in the post-colonial period, in the post-war period of tax havens, had everything to do with decolonization, because people who had all of this money in the colonies did not want to bring it back to metropolitan centers to be taxed. So the creation of offshoring was a consequence of a process of decolonization that still let wealthy, you know, wealthy white people protect their wealth. Right. And so there is a direct history there of race. How do we close those loopholes? How do we actually financially reward key workers and change the way we pay people? And finally, a question from Imogen Richmond Bishop, who asks who is keen to hear about racist immigration measures that drive insecurity for these communities, but give them no recourse to public funds, right? So we rely on immigration systems that are fundamentally exploitative and racist. What do we do about all of these institutions beyond recognizing the ways in which they work? And I will have that be the final set of questions. Anyone can jump in.
So I think for me, one thing that I found really frustrating at the beginning of the COVID crisis was the whole thing of it's a crisis. For lots of communities, we live in constant crisis, right? So when I was, you know, like finding just everywhere, it was like, it's a crisis. And I think daily, Black people are killed by the police. Daily, Black people are like exposed to unsafe working environments and not paid for it. Daily, Black people are, you know, victims to white supremacist violence. So I think a lot of what we're seeing during the COVID crisis is stuff that was already happening anyway, but has just been elevated by just, I don't know, I feel like everyone else, for me, it felt like lots of other people who are not people of color are kind of waking up to just how bad the system is. So I think with the COVID crisis, it's something that had been happening anyway. And I think something else that's been, I don't know, I forgot to mention earlier, it's just like the idea of like, you know, disability and the economy. And like, cause it kind of ties into conversations around care and how it's undervalued and how specific bodies who are seen as not contributing to capitalism are, and it kind of goes back to the thing of value. And I think with the COVID crisis, we've seen how sickness and, you know, health are really huge factors in, I don't know, you've seen how sickness and health are just things that capitalism is not interested in, and it's just been made very, very obvious. And I personally don't have the answers for what that would look like to shift that, because I mean, I'm sure there's so many other people who have the answers for that, but I'm really interested to see how post-COVID crisis, how we will work, how we will think about how disability justice is related to economic justice as well and racial capitalism. And I think in terms of taxes, I also don't know the answer, but we're also we are working on a piece of research with Tax Justice UK about the tax to do research on tax havens, and maybe that's something that we'll have an answer for in a bit as well. And I think one thing that I kind of wanted to say, which is kind of maybe taking us back to the question before, sorry, I think one thing about I think I kept on thinking about how we can't really universalize specific, we can't universalize economic ideas across all contexts, right? And I think this is where like what Felicia was talking about in terms of like diversifying economic thought and that what would look like. So I really like that question about what it means to be socialist in a different country when it hasn't, you know, it doesn't look the way that we would think it does. And I think this is why we really need like a diversified approach to economic ideas, which is kind of more like place-based and community-based, which kind of links to mutual aid networks and cooperatives. I'm so interested to think about like how post-COVID crisis and just how generally we can kind of have a bit more of like indigenous knowledge, or not even just like collective place-based knowledge to deal with economic structures that people in communities need, as opposed to universalizing or economic, because, you know, that's colonialism, the universalizing of whiteness and white experiences. Like, how can we challenge that in the types of economic ideas that we're thinking of?
Can I jump in here? I mean, I just would say a couple of things, really. I mean, to think right at the beginning, I talked about, you know, us being, you know, capitalism and the economy, the economic ideas being a structure of power. And just because we've had a crisis in relation to COVID doesn't mean that that structure of power or what it's trying to do will change. In fact, you know, I'm doing some work at the moment looking at what the reactions to COVID have been. From, you know, rising sort of right-wing libertarian governments and ideas and networks that are in power around the world. And it's been to intensify exploitation, to intensify deregulation even more shift of power balance in favor of business. And so we have to, you know, we don't call this a struggle for nothing, because it is a struggle. And actually, when you ask what do we have to do to change? Actually, it's very simple, really. We have to organise, which is why, you know, from my perspective, you know, in terms of the world of work, I'd say right now, you all need to, if you're not in a union, join a union, not just join a union, be active in it and be part of the discussion and be part of actually driving what that union does to make change. Because it's only through that solidarity that we're going to generate the power to change these things. For me, capitalism and its latest form, neoliberalism, isn't just economics, it's an ideology. And it's an ideology which is based on, which is promoted to make people accept the oppression that they're living under. So, you know, we have to challenge those ideas. But we have to organise if we want change, because that's what history teaches us, that nobody at the top is going to come along and say, oh, well, you know, we realise we've done wrong, folks, and that we're sorry that you've all died and that people are living in poverty. You know, as I said to a bunch of trade unionists earlier this day, today, turkeys don't vote for Christmas, right? And no capitalist is going to come along and say, sorry, I was wrong for exploiting you all. I'm going to give you your money back, and I'm going to pay you the value for what you're worth. You know, we have to organise to force that change.
And finally, Felicia, since you work in the domain of policy every single day, maybe I'll hand it over to you to tell us what institutional change looks like and how it comes about.
For me, when it comes in the area of policy, I do genuinely believe that having and recruiting more people with different perspectives, different backgrounds, different experiences into the policy field will help formulate and change policy. But obviously, as you know, as civil servants, we answer to the government of the day. So that is a little bit tricky for trying to, you know, start a revolution. However, I do think that it's important that we do include different perspectives, because that's the only way we're going to change things. We need to have a different ideas of what currently is, in order to make some real change. I generally don't think I have anything else to add than what everyone has said here today, because everyone has just hit the nail on the head for me. It's been great. I've really enjoyed this panel. I definitely think we need to start expanding our minds and to what could be the possibilities, because all the greatest innovations just started with somebody having a better idea and organizing and just going at it and not taking no for an answer. So that's me.
Okay, well, with that, we've overshot a little bit, but it was such a valuable conversation. I couldn't be more thrilled to be here for this evening. Thank you all in the audience for sticking with us for this long. But let me just thank our panelists. Join me in thanking our panelists and thank you for attending. I encourage you to find out more about what's happening at the III, either by following the link at the beginning of this chat or by going to the III's website. I hope everyone has a good night. Thanks again.